We'll start the meeting at this moment. We don't have a quorum, so we'll just get charged with hearing of House File 1071, which is second on the agenda.
Mr. Chair and members, this is House File 1071. It establishes a statewide hearing aid loan bank to help children get hearing aids, and I have a number of testifiers here to talk, and why don't we get right to them? So, go ahead.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Coverstone. I'm an audiologist with the University of Minnesota and the coordinator of the Lions Open Hearing Program and the current loaner aid bank. First, I'd like to thank Representative Huntley for introducing this important legislation and thank the members of the committee for taking the time to hear testimony today. With the advent of universal newborn hearing screening in Minnesota, the need for amplification in a timely fashion has become even more critical. There remains a gap in time between infants and children being identified with hearing loss and the time in which they are fit with appropriate amplification. In 2001, the Hearing Instrument Loaner Bank was established to fill that gap. This program provides a valuable service during the time that a child is first identified with hearing loss and when payment for hearing instruments can be accomplished. It offers the family a chance to take a breath and determine all of their options without the child having to wait for access to language. Sometimes families are in discussions with their insurance companies on whether or not hearing aids are available or warranted. Other times it may take a little extra time to enroll the family in programs to qualify for hearing aid coverage. Some families still need additional time to personally cover the cost of $3,000 to $6,000 for the hearing aids. Without the availability of this program, meaningful critical time can be lost for the child. Research shows that if a child with hearing loss has access to language before 6 months of age, they can learn speech and language along with their hearing peers. Access to language can be any combination of signing and hearing. Immediate access to hearing aids for these families can help ensure that their child has all communication options available. The funds for this program would cover the cost of a physician, postage, supplies, printing. The physician, as the physician coordinator, it's their job to get the donations for the top-of-the-line hearing instruments. And currently, we have preferred donations in the amount of over $400,000 in the equipment. So it definitely leverages a lot. Minnesota Lions have been generous and a consistent sponsor of this program. However, their initial funding has been exceeded. Commitment to early intervention and the current statewide program has ensured that the loaner bank is seen as an indispensable benefit to the community. Continued coordination of this program is needed to ensure that every infant has access to language before 6 months of age, which is critical to the outcomes of newly identified babies with hearing loss. Thank you for your consideration and support of early hearing detection and intervention.
Thank you, Ms. Coverstone. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nicole Brown, and this is a picture of my daughter, Sophia, who couldn't make it today because she didn't want to miss preschool, and my youngest daughter, Linnea. And I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about the importance of the loaner bank, hearing aid loaner bank, and what it means to children and families with hearing loss. In 2002, my daughter Sophia was diagnosed with a severe congenital hearing loss at about 6 weeks of age. As you can imagine, for a first-time parent with no experience with hearing loss, this was just devastating news for us. We didn't know what her future would look like. One horrifying statistic for a child with hearing loss similar to hers played over and over in our mind, a third-grade reading level at her high school graduation. We ask ourselves how should we communicate with our friends and our family. We didn't know what to expect from her future. When Sophia was 2 months old, she began early intervention services to our school district. And she received her first pair of loaner hearing aids when she was 4 months old. From day one, she never wanted to take them out. She loved hearing all the sounds around her. It took a few trials with a few different kinds of hearing aids before our audiologist was satisfied which hearing aid was best for her and which one she could hear the best with. Through our insurance, we purchased her first pair of hearing aids when she was about 9 months old. And she wore every day for about 3 years until just recently when she received a cochlear implant. Sophia is a true testament to the benefits of early intervention. Next fall, she's going to be starting kindergarten with her classmates and her classmates, friends, and peers. On standardized assessment tests, she scores above average in speech and language skills compared to her hearing peers. I'm a proud mom. Now, I feel I can once again embrace those dreams and expectations I had for her on the day that she was born. Last August, our third daughter, Linnea, was born. And again, we waited anxiously for her results, for her newborn hearing screening results at the hospital. And unfortunately, she didn't pass. At 10 days of age, she was diagnosed with a profound hearing loss. We were told she was deaf. Less than 1 week later, she received her first pair of hearing aids from the Loaner Hearing Aid Bank. And for the first time, she was able to hear my voice. These hearing aids, the ones she's wearing right now, were provided on an interim basis from the Loaner Bank until she receives her cochlear implant next month. We were really appreciative that we didn't need to spend the $6,000 on hearing aids just for those 6 months that she needed them. To ensure that every newborn baby has an equal chance and the same opportunities as Sophia and Linnea to reach their full potential, all babies should receive newborn hearing screening, further diagnosis, and an intervention if needed. And in order to assure that earliest access to sound, all infants with a hearing loss should have access to the hearing aid loaner bank. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Brown, and to the littlest Brown, too. Any questions for the testifiers? Real quickly, I should call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. And Representative Huntley moves House File 1071 to be considered in front of the committee. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huntley, how many families could be affected by this bill in the state? Talking about the library.
Ms. Coverstone.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, currently the program has helped over 100 families for the past year, and already this year we are seeing more than what we helped during this part of last year. But helping the families is not just in numbers, but the cost of hearing aids is what is so astronomical at this point. So leveraging over $400,000 for the equipment. Thank you.
Yep. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, have there been families that, because of lack of funding, not gotten the help?
Ms. Coverstone.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, families have used the loaner bank for 2 months, some of them. We've been flexible and have used it for over a year. We don't just pull the amplification off of them in some way, shape, or form, whether it's through their personal insurance, fighting with the insurance companies, or getting them signed up. I personally do not know of a family that hasn't come up with the dollars, but some of the families personally have to come up with the dollars, whether it's through donations from service clubs or through programs like that. I mean, eventually they're able to get their own personal, but it can be a struggle.
Thank you.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question about how people statewide access this. Is there a hotline or...
Ms. Coverstone.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, currently they email me or call me. Right now it's just me as the audiologist. I go over what we currently have in inventory and fax that to the audiologist. I look at the hearing loss to determine which hearing for preparing eggs would be appropriate and based on what we have in stock, and then send the hearing aids, at least with one package of batteries, any supplies that I have gotten through donations, like a care kit for the families, so that they have everything they need at that time, and then send it out to the audiologist. So it's available statewide, and families across the state have accessed it. Once I communicate ongoing with the audiologist and answer any additional questions or help the families in any way that I can, and then once we receive the hearing aids back, and I run the appropriate check and such, we do send a survey out to the families to ask how the program was a benefit to them, where do they receive their funding, and any comments from them as well.
Representative Gottlob. Mr. Chair, and the $140,000 will be used how? I understand it's listed here for administrative expenses, but how exactly will that be fitting into the picture? Ms. Coverson.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, right now the $140,000 would be for a two-year period. It would cover the cost of the coordinating position, and it would also cover the cost of printing, postage, supplies, and that coordinating position, again, leverages the hearing aids, the instruments, the other donations of batteries and accessories and whatnot. Okay.
Thank you.
I just have one question, and this is from personal experience. When I was little, I would lose hearing aids every once in a while, and it would cause tensions in the family. What would happen if there is a lost or damaged aid? Is there insurance that's covered through the loan program?
Mr. Chair and members, currently we have only, since 2001, I'm happy to say we have only lost, only three hearing aids have been lost. So that in itself is pretty wonderful, and was a concern when we first threw the program together to fill this need. But we do carry insurance on the hearing aids that the program themselves own. But most of the what I've been working hard to do is have the manufacturers cycle current hearing technology through our bank. So we don't have to cover the cost of the repair and the lost hearing aid. For example, one company, it would write it off, whereas another company would, say, take a depreciative value and then subtract an additional amount, and we'd pay that. But we haven't had to outright cover any costs.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, losing hearing aids must be exception to the rule. you fit that, I guess.
Well, Representative Anderson, I think I lost three or four of them, and it would lead to interesting conversations between my father and I. Any further discussion or questions? With none being so, House File 1071 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the final omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We're going to represent Fritz now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Representative Patty Frist from District 26B, Faribault, Minnesota, and I have House File 1361. I'd like to move.
Representative Frist moves 1361.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that appropriates money for a deaf and hard of hearing mentor program. The deaf mentor program is a program that was developed through the Sky High Institute, a nationally recognized institution that develops early intervention programs for children with disabilities and their families. 95% of children with hearing loss have parents who are hearing. Most have never met a deaf or hard of hearing adult. Parents are often overwhelmed when they learn their child is deaf. This program provides them with the opportunity to meet a person who is deaf and successful. parents are able to make decisions out of hope and not fear. Those families that choose to sign as a communication choice have a difficult time finding places to learn, attending the classes, and balancing the needs of the rest of their family. The program provides specially trained mentors who go into the home of a parent that has chosen sign language as a method of communication for the child and teaches sign language and deaf culture to the family. This is an evidence-based practice that has been proven to lead to increased language development. Families that choose sign language as a method of communication are learning it within months of their diagnosis. By having the deaf mentor come into the home and teach sign to the entire family, the child's language acquisition accelerates and the child is integrated into the entire family. And members, I have a testifier, Tony Fairbanks, who is a deaf mentor. Tony?
Hello. Thank you very much, Representative Fritz, for allowing me to come, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Tony Fairbanks. I'm from Ogema, and for the past 4 years, I have worked with people as a deaf mentor. It's been a wonderful program. I've been very impressed with it. This program has been through the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services. I was trained as a deaf mentor using the National Sky High Deaf Mentor Training Curriculum. The curriculum is designed for deaf adults to help families and who have deaf babies to learn sign language. That way, the parents are able to facilitate their deaf child's language development. Now, very specifically, the curriculum includes teaching and modeling of the early visual communication, American Sign Language, and culture. By the learning of sign language, deaf mentors also help parents to see their deaf child's options and that they have the potential for success. Deaf mentors are selected based on their fluency in American Sign Language, their ability to communicate easily with the hearing families, and their comfort with young children and their ability to support the family's decisions. Let me explain a little bit that hearing kids can pick up language easily just simply by hearing. They listen to their parents, their grandparents, their family members, their friends, the TV, the radio. All of this comes to them vicariously. While as deaf babies, they're not able to pick up that sound as they're sitting there. They're not picking up any of that language. So they don't pick up English incidentally. And if their parents don't know how to sign, they can't pick up sign language. So for these babies, there is no communication around them from the beginning. So it's important that they be able to develop the sign language in these critical years of age 0 to 3. They need a deaf mentor who will be able to be there to help them learn sign language so that they can help the deaf baby then to pick up language skills before they enter preschool and later kindergarten. At that time then, we would want the deaf child to be on par with their hearing peers, and the deaf child can be mainstreamed in classrooms using sign language interpreters. I've been a mentor with families with 1 3-year-old boy and a 1-year-old boy. Their families have learned so much. They've learned exactly what to do and how to communicate with their children, and the 3-year-old is now 7, and he signs so well. He has a great vocabulary and is able to communicate very well. The other boy will soon be 2 years old, and his mother has been very motivated on learning sign. She signs very well and is also able to communicate with her son. He now knows over 25 words in sign language at a very young age. Now again, each child is different, and a deaf mentor can make such a big difference in their lives. If there were no mentor, the deaf parents wouldn't know what to do to develop communication. So please support this bill so that the deaf mentor services can be provided to families of deaf babies when they really need it and they can see the wonderful success. Thank you again.
Thank you, Tony. One more testifier.
Ms. Hardman.
Mr.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for giving us the opportunity to testify today. Three last testifiers, we're talking about providing and developing a system of support for families once their babies are newly identified. The Speaker of the House has introduced legislation that would require that the hospitals screen babies at birth and report them to the Department of Health. We're in the bottom five of states that for our reporting and our screening and reporting to the Department of Health. We hope to turn that around when the bill passes this year, and then we want to have a system of supports in place for families once those children are identified. Service organization dollars have been used to pay for the hearing aid bank and for the deaf mentors. We want this to be part of the infrastructure that parents can rely upon once their baby is identified. And these two pieces that you just heard guarantee that families would have immediate amplification and immediate exposure to language, if sign language, if that's the communication modality they choose. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. First, can you tell us how the $80,000 appropriation would be used?
It would be used for the mentoring program, and the I'll have Ms. Hart probably add to that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Erickson, actually we have somebody from the Department of Human Services here, but the way that it would be used, the department actually trained, and you see before you the curriculum, the department in the past trained deaf mentors, and the grants, I believe that they would contract individually with deaf mentors when parents ask for that. Deaf mentors to be provided, they would be contracting with these individuals. And our hope is that with this $40,000, parents know about the service, know that they can ask for the service, and that later on it becomes covered through either Part C dollars, through the Individual Disabilities Education Act as part of the services that are provided, or are provided through Medicaid as a benefit. But that hasn't been established clearly yet. That was actually a suggestion of Senator Berglund. And actually, I believe the department can speak to more specifically. There's a representative here, I believe.
Representative Erickson, do you want to hear from the Human Services Department?
Yes, thank you, from the department.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Hodek. I'm the Director for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division, and I am responsible for the 8 regional service centers in Minnesota. In response to your question, we've had a mechanism in place for the last couple years working with parents on establishing a mentoring program. Part of the issue we struggle with has been the funding to pay for these mentoring services, for their travel, and pay for their hourly fee, and their prep time, of course. So this funding would help pay for that, because with our experience, working with trying to find money through other resources has been contacting civic clubs, for example, the Lions Club, Saratoga. So that's been a struggle, raising funds to pay for these services. If we had the funding established, we would be able to pay for these services and be able to add even more mentors statewide.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. To the testifier, how long would the deaf mentor be engaged with the family, and how many families would we serve?
Mr. Hodek.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the question related to numbers, we're estimating be about 10 families, and it would vary from family to family as far as hours, depending on the need that the family would have.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my own mind, I keep thinking there's got to be more than 10 families in the state. Is this enough?
Mr. Hodak.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's our estimate at this time. It's about 10 families that are requesting this, so 40,000 won't go very far, that's correct.
Ms. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we actually just put this in that amount, the $40,000, hoping that it would be recognized and as a service and to develop a system that is more continuous and then to use the time over the next 2 years to try to develop it as one of the benefits within Medicaid, you know, within Medicaid for children, for children and families that it hasn't been tapped into and into Part C dollars. There really hasn't been, we've had a voluntary system of newborn screening. We haven't had a mandatory system. You heard the testimony, I remember you asked really great questions when we had our presenter come in. And we, as we go from the voluntary system of screening, we want to have an infrastructure. We're building an infrastructure. We have right here just, if you see, look in your sheet, it's in blue. I get the cheap copies, you get the blue copies. It says mandate newborn screening and build a human service and education system that promotes normal language development. We're trying to do systems building so families have something that we can rely upon.
So. Did that answer your question, Representative Gottwald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does. I hope that as we provide some state funding under this, that we don't lose the community connection, because having been involved with organizations such as that, I think that's really essential. We need to keep that community partnership as well.
Ms. Hartnett, are these kids automatically eligible for medical assistance, or does it depend on the family income?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these are uncharted waters as far as the benefit that we were talking about, and I'm not an expert on that, and so I couldn't answer that question.
Other questions? Representative Walker.
Chair, I came in late, and I do apologize for that. Is there an estimate on how many children would be eligible? How many families would be eligible?
Ms. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Warford, there are an estimated 10 to 15 families that we'd be served with these dollars, and we're hoping that once this is identified as a benefit that families can rely upon, and we will continue, I believe the families will continue to look to service organizations, but it takes so much time to do that. They're losing time if they're going out, you know, begging for these dollars, and then the kids aren't getting the exposure to the language. So we're hoping that it becomes part of, you know, with the 10 to 15, that the word spreads, that this is a great service, and then parents can then try to access that service through the Department of Education Part C dollars or through the Medicaid benefit that's dedicated. And actually, I believe that there's a 71%. I looked on the website. They say that if there's a 71% underutilization of that benefit nationally. So,
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked, just wanted to know how many that you were aware of, because I do know families that aren't aware of it. I wasn't as familiar with this this program until the bill arrived, and I'm thankful, Representative Fritz, that you brought this forward. I have several constituents that would benefit from this and aren't aware of these services, and I actually have a step-niece that's 13 that would benefit personally from these services. It's one of those things that, especially if you, like testimony has already said, if you're coming into a family that hearing is taken for granted, and then you have a young person and trying to incorporate that person's needs amongst everyone else, sometimes some things get overlooked. And so while we have to struggle with priorities, I do think this is a good idea.
Other questions? Okay, House File 1361 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Fritz and Ms. Hartnett.
Thank you, Chair Huntley and members. Thank you very much.
Oh, and Ms. Hartnett, you, we're going to hear House File 842 on Thursday, I believe. And I understand you have some people here that would like to testify on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we have one person that's here, John Clark, to testify. 842 has a line item in it that would allocate funds and that would allow deaf, blind children and adults to access, I believe, 80 more, about 80 more people would be served in the state if those funds are allocated. It was actually in your bill, Representative Huntley. And 10 years ago, I remember coming to the legislature for the first time, and you were the chief author of the bill that instituted these wonderful services. And I know the time is tight, and we said that we wouldn't take much time, but I invite all of the representatives, the committee members, we put a piece together that invites you to put on blindfolds and earplugs and just try doing the simplest task for a minute or two, and see how valuable these services are. And we have, with competing priorities, I know it's very difficult to make decisions, but we hope that you can be supportive of these essential services. We had a parent here, and she wasn't able to testify last week, but her testimony is at part of this handout. But I'd like to introduce John Clark, who will talk about the value of these services.
And for members that don't know, 842 is the governor's big human services bill. And Representative Gottlow, do you want to ask a question now or wait until later?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to move the minutes, but when it's appropriate.
Are you ready?
Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Clark, and I want to greet you all. I wanted to explain to you about my most important tool for overcoming barriers in my world. You know, the world that we all live in is very clearly designed for people who can see and people who can hear. And as a person who is both deaf and blind, there's a lot of information that's in the world that I don't have access to. And so I need special tools in order to access this information and overcome these barriers. And my most important tool is not a computer or a machine or a thing. It's a person, a trained and skilled professional person. And we call those people support service providers, or SSPs. And this is Clyde, who is my support service provider today. An SSP, or support service provider, is a professional person who provides many, many different kinds of services to help meet the varied needs of deafblind people. And for deafblind people, the world is a complicated place. There are a lot of avenues to communication that are blocked for us. There's a lot of different things that people depend on hearing and sight for. Deafblind people come from a lot of different backgrounds and from a lot of different experience, and an SSP can provide services that can meet all the varied needs of deafblind people. They're very skilled at changing, modifying their approach to be able to meet a deafblind person's needs, whatever they are. And to give you some examples of how I use a support service provider, I'll give you a few examples if you don't mind. Weekly, I sit down with a support service provider and go through my mail. Read through my mail, make sure that my bills are all paid. And the support service provider lets me know how much my bill is so that I can write checks and make sure that my bills are paid. That's one example of how they help. But there are all kinds of different forms that come in the mail, form applications for school, for paying my taxes, and the support service provider is able to see all of this information and make sure that I am aware of everything that comes to me in the mail. That's one example. Another example is going grocery shopping. I can cook independently. That's not a problem for me. But going to the grocery store, knowing which foods I'm buying, that's difficult. So an SSP, a support service provider, can go with me so that I can select the foods that I need in order to be able to prepare them for myself. And everything works out fine. So going to the store is another example. Another example is that recently I moved to a new apartment. And I didn't know the area well. And the whole area was new to me. And my support service, with support help from my support service provider, I was able to explore the area that I was living to learn where everything was in the apartment and in the neighborhood around the apartment. And once I am cognizant of where everything is in the area, then beyond that, I can be independent. I'm able to function independently, but I need that initial support. Another example is in my new apartment, it has a stove, and I'm very capable of cooking independently. I have stickers on things that let me know where everything is, and but in order to get that set up, I need somebody who can see. So my support service provider can help me to get that my stove set up so that I'm capable of using it independently from that point on. There are two different kinds of services that a support service provider provides. One kind of service is ongoing. And those are services that don't stop, like reading the mail. Like going to the grocery store. That's something I need continuously. I can't stop doing either of those two things. But some of the services that they provide for me are very initial services that then allow me to build my independence and to function independently in the world. Another example is my doctor moved to a different clinic, and I didn't know the area where the clinic was. And so with a support service provider, I was able to learn about that area, and after that I was able to go to that clinic by myself independently. So there are a lot of very important services that support service providers provide for deafblind people. Understand that my support service provider doesn't make decisions for me. I make the decisions. But I really need a support service provider as a tool to give me the information that I need to make good decisions. And I'm hoping that clarifies for you how critically important support service providers are for deafblind people. And if you can just imagine what would happen for me if I did not have access to this service, no support service provider, I probably wouldn't be able to do my taxes. You know, how would I even do it? The police would come and take me away. arrest me for tax evasion, perhaps. If I went to the grocery store and in order to figure out what the food was that I was buying, I'd have to open the package and taste it to see what it is. Is that what I want or not? And I don't think that the store owners would be very happy with me if that's the way I approached my grocery shopping. And I'm kind of kidding, but you can see how seriously important a support service provider is for creating a bridge for people who are deaf-blind to really just smooth the way and take down some of the barriers that exist for people who are deaf-blind. And I'm wondering if any of the committee members have questions for me about support service providers and how important they are. I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Gottwald has a question for Mr. Clark, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to thank you for coming and speaking to us. My question is, and it's for my own education, how many deafblind people are in need of these services, the numbers statewide?
Well, really, around the state, there are about 800 deafblind people. I believe that all of them need some support services. How much each of those people need varies. But there is a huge need for it because, especially for people who live in rural areas or people who live in the city like me, there are huge needs in both of those areas, and it's really important. Some people get 5 hours of support service provider services in a week, and some people need more. And out in a rural area, it's much harder to get around. It's much there are a lot more barriers for people in rural areas, and they may have more significant needs than somebody that, like me, who lives in an urban area. So the needs are varied, but I think everybody needs some sort of service.
Thank you very much.
Any more questions?
There are additional questions. Representative Fritz.
I just have a comment, Mr. Chairman. I have taken care of a resident in my nursing home in Faribault for 20 years. Who is deaf and blind, and she always recognized we nurses by our wedding rings, so she could always knew Mrs. Fritz by her wedding ring. So, but she came as a young woman, and of course that was a lot of money for 20 years. And I'm just wondering, I'm going to have to go down and see if she's still there. I'll have to renew my friendship with her. Thank you for coming today.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. And thank you so much for your time and for listening to my testimony. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, thank you. And that bill will be heard, as I said, on Thursday. It's Representative Tao. Oh, and Representative Gottwald has been anxiously looking at the minutes and has decided that they're all correct, and he moved the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I looked them over from end to end, and they're absolutely accurate.
Any discussion of the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify approval by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. Representative Tao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'd like to move House File 707.
House File 707 has been moved.
For possible inclusion. Thank you, members. This pretty simple bill. We're going to do a study to see the needs for dental service for people with disability. As many of you know, those of you who are in the policy committee, dental health access is tough for a lot of the folks with disability because we do not reimburse our dentists as well as the private payers, and so not many dentists are willing to provide access to them. And so we're going to study to see if there's some recommendations to make sure that these folks get access. I looked at the fiscal note, it only costs $49, so no answer.
Now I understand.
I know, $49,000, so it's pretty modest. I have with me Mr. Cheetah, and he'll talk a little bit more. We also have a dentist in the room, and if you have questions, he will be here to answer them. Go ahead, Mr. Cheetah.
Mr. Cheetah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Tao. For the record, I'm John Cheetah from Peart Center, also co-chair of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, a cross-disability coalition representing about 100 different organizations.
And a graduate of Creighton High School. Sorry.
And a proud graduate, Mr. Chairman, of Creighton High School. Too bad Representative Emmer isn't in the room. I always give him a hard time. He's a cadet, and we're sorry for him. A friendly rival. Mr. Chair, members, as Representative Tao mentioned, he mentioned the economic challenges facing both our dental providers and consumers with disabilities. Part of that is a reimbursement challenge to the providers, certainly, and part of that is a cost-sharing challenge to people with disabilities themselves. Other areas that we'd really like to study are geographic access. There's been some very good work done within the Department of Human Services and the Dental Advisory Committee there to look at the needs of special needs populations when it comes to dental service. They've done some great work in developing an alternative service model, and Dr. Helgeson from Appletree Dental is here if you'd like to hear more about that. But what really hasn't been done is to look at the nature of geography. As I said, are there parts of the state that are more challenged than others when it comes to access for folks with disabilities of any age? And to be clear, I'm not just talking about the working age population, but our seniors and our pediatric population as well. And finally, the area of physical access is something we need to look at. Part of that is just buildings and infrastructure getting into the offices themselves. Part of that is examination rooms, and is the equipment accessible, and are people able to access the equipment. So I thank you for your support and your consideration of this proposal.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I always ask when I see study, and I mentioned this earlier to Representative Tallis, if we know there's a need out there already, and I know this isn't a lot of money, and if a study's necessary, great, that's kind of going to be my question, but shouldn't we get to work on the problem if we know it exists rather than studying it, is kind of my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, it's an excellent question. I think the answer is there are some good things that have already happened. I think the designation of critical access dental providers is one of them, and we now have over 200 of those folks enrolled statewide. So on the economic side, I think we're starting to address that problem. Relative to the physical access and geographic access, I think those are questions that we have not asked. There are a number of other legislative proposals addressing the economic side and the reimbursement side, some pilot programs, for example. And there are members of this committee who have co-sponsored that legislation, and we're also supportive of those efforts. But this question of, are there areas of the state that are really more challenged than others? And from the actual physical space concerns, we'd really like to get our arms around those challenges.
The governor's budget has $10 million, I believe, for dental critical access for various populations. Representative Abler.
And Mr. Chair, to the idea of a study or not, I think Representative Gottwald and others, I think sometimes we request a study in an effort to provide a policy direction to a department that we think might need a little urging. And I think there's a bunch of people that would like to do stuff, and then there's these layers of leadership that have other priorities, and I think it's just a way to kind of give them a nudge. So I hope that they take the nudge and take the money and do it.
Any further questions? Seeing none, House File 707 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr. Cheeta. And thank you, Representative Powell.
Representative Huntley moves House File 911 for consideration in front of the committee. To the bill. Oh, I'm sorry. That's House File 1297.
Thank you.
Wrong spot on the agenda. I apologize.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not going to spend a lot of time. Bruce can try at the bill, but we've had a number of bills, and this committee, in its final bill, is going to have to decide the balance between COLAs, equalization of rural versus metro long-term care rates, and then also proposal in Fritz's bill. Representative Fritz's bill on rebasing, and we probably can't afford to do all three. Certainly we're going to do a COLA. The question is, do we do equalization or do we do rebasing? I think it's the other approach. And we've heard a number of bills on these already, and 1297 is another bill, and I'll turn it over to Bruce.
Mr. Welcome, Chair, members of the division, thank you, Representative Huntley. Indeed, there have been a number of COLA bills in Representative Greiling's mental health bill and the governor's bill, the senior worker coalition. There are actually two coming from a coalition I work with, the COLA coalition, made up of mostly the providers who get the COLA and then pass it on to employees. And there are actually two bills that from the COLA coalition, and one of them is House File 1267, which provides for a 7% and 6% increase, just as Representative Fritz's bill initially. We also, Representative Huntley also offered a bill that's identical to that. It's House File 972, pulled from the agenda, identical except that had a blank line. Now, I testified last week. We had a remarkable testifier. It was 6 o'clock in the morning, typo. 1297. Thank you, Representative Huntley. Had a testifier last week, Rita McAnish Hastings, who did a wonderful job describing what the direct support professionals do, so I'm not going to get into a whole lot of that. But the bill before you today, House File 1297, comes. It has just a placeholder in it for nursing homes, and much of the nursing home elements that Representative Huntley described are in Representative Fritz's bill. Now, I represent ARM. ARM is an organization of about 160 providers who support people with disabilities in ICFSMR and the various waivers, the DD waiver, CADI waiver, CAC waiver, SILS, and other programs. We, our members, employ about 27,000 what we call direct support professionals. Those are the people who provide the day-in and day-out supports to people with disabilities. And as we mentioned last week, the rate changes increases over the last 4 years for not only direct support professionals, but the operating costs as well have been about an increase of about 3.53%, and that's versus an inflation rate over that time of 12.77. So you can see the purchasing power for direct support professionals and for the programs that do the that run the programs hasn't kept up. There's been a lot of discussion around the various COLA bills about the encumbrance, the amount that would be dedicated to go to eligible employees. In our industry, that's the direct support professionals. And the bill moving forward, I believe Representative Fritz's bill had 75% that would be encumbered. That, from our point of view, would be the absolute maximum, or if you look at the other way, the 25% would be the bare minimum. And here's why. If you took the governor's bill, which had 2% in it, and look at the average cost that DHS has presented for an individual in the DD waiver, and then do the math all the way through to how much money is left in that 25% of a 2% COLA per group home, come up with $1,179 a year. And out of that, we pay for the housing and food that's not covered by group residential housing, and that's a significant sum. The training, all the training of staff, a new person who comes in, there's 41%, by the way, annual turnover across the state, with about half of those turning over again in the first six months of their employment. Those folks go through an orientation of about 40 hours, and then there's additional training of around 15 hours a year. So that money comes out of that 25%. Gas and transportation, people going to the doctor, doing activities in the community, that comes out of the 25%. Administration, heating the building, ads in the newspaper to try to hire new people, that turnover. So that money isn't squandered. It's very tight indeed at 25%. And so we ask if you consider that as the bill moves forward, as it's laid over for possible consideration. And there, one difference, I prepared for Representative Huntley a number of, there's a lot of little differences of what's in one bill and what's not in another bill, and I won't belabor that. You can talk about that as the bill moves forward and you're putting together the omnibus bill. But one element that is important, I think, to us in how the money is encumbered, and that is that there be a certain amount of flexibility within that 75% of the division, indeed 75%, so that our folks can honor people who are stupendous workers and more than, say, the people who are coming in and out every 6 months or so. There is also a provision in this bill before you today that's not in the other bill, Representative Fritz's bill, and that's a separate increase for minimum wage. And the reason that's in there, as you know, the federal government is, I think, likely about to pass in the next few months increases in minimum wage. And the first one, it'll be a three-tiered increase, the way it's written now. The first one will still be below Minnesota's minimum wage. But the next one and then the following one will then bump up ahead of Minnesota's minimum wage. We use minimum wage for sleep time, almost always sleep time staff only. People, college students, for example, paid to sleep at night. So the provision in this bill says for sleep time staff only who are paid minimum wage, that they would have that increment when they bump up above Minnesota's minimum wage would be paid for separately. And the reason for that is, if you take the money, that 75%, say, of the COLA, and have to divert it to people to sleep, you are taking money away from the folks who do the day-in and day-out supports for people with disabilities. There are also some provisions in this bill that aren't in the other regarding managed care that we hope stay in there, so that the money is assured to pass through the managed care entities and on to providers and ultimately people as direct support professionals. I'll leave it with that unless there are other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And just for the official record, we do need to have you state your name.
I forgot. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I am Bruce Nelson from ARM.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, do you have a... No? Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huntley, could you give us a ballpark figure? I see you don't have a fiscal note for 1297.
We don't have enough. Representative Erickson and Mr. Chair first, and then Representative Erickson. We don't have a fiscal note yet, but we're anticipating that it would be around $300 million. The governor had a 2% and 2%, which is, I believe, $92 million. And $300 million is a lot of money.
Any other questions or discussions? Any final comments, Representative Huntley?
No, just that we're going to have to sit down as a group and draw a balance between COLAs, equalizations, and rebasing. And those won't be easy decisions. But I don't know about the rest of the members of this committee, but... I believe we just have to do something about a COLA. I mean, that's sort of my bottom line for this year.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. With that being said, then House File 1297 is laid over for inclusion into the final omnibus bill. For possible inclusion.
I think next we'll do House File 1583, Representative Nelson. See you're there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I'll move the bill.
1583 has been moved. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 1583 is a bill that would provide for payments, a payment rate adjustment, and allow an intermediate care facility in Brooklyn Park to change its current configuration. The current 32-bed facility is operated by Homeward Bound and would be reconfigured to provide 4 6-bed facilities for persons with developmental disabilities. In making this change, there is a transitional cost which will require higher interim rate, and there will be need for somewhat higher payment rate to operate in this new configuration over the long term. This new configuration would provide for smaller settings for persons with developmental disabilities in an effective way to serve this population. I have with me Mr. Don Preeb from Homeward Bound, the organization who is seeking this, to reconfigure its services. Mr. Preeb will explain more about the request, and then we can stand for questions from the committee.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to appear on behalf of Homeward Bound and House File 1583. I am Don Preeby, the CEO of Homeward Bound. House File 1583 is intended to eliminate the bleak future for 31 individuals with severe disabilities who live at Homeward Bound's 32-bed ICFMR facility in Brooklyn Park. By severe disabilities, I mean the combination of severe levels of intellectual disability, such as mental retardation, physical disabilities that severely limit mobility, communication, and range of motion, and medical conditions that require sophisticated health care delivered by nursing staff, and that may also involve life-threatening conditions. Homeward Bound has developed a plan for downsizing and closing this facility called relocation in consultation with Hennepin County, the Disabilities Division at DHS, and the ARC. We do not have formal Hennepin County support, but the disability staff at the county have indicated that they do support our plan informally. We also have ARC support. House File 1583 is intended to financially support this plan by providing a one-time rate adjustment to the Brooklyn Park rate, which will fund the increased costs at the smaller homes, and by providing an interim rate to fund the closure. Our current rate is not sufficient to fund the closure, nor is it sufficient to fund the smaller homes going forward. Homeward Bound is a venerable nonprofit agency. We were started in 1973 by families who had kids with the kinds of severe disabilities that I've described to you. We built a home for these kids in New Hope in 1976. And then in 1979, we built the program that we're talking about now, the Brooklyn Park facility, for adults. And for many years, that program was state of the art. Just to give you an idea of the kinds of disabilities that the people have who live at Brooklyn Park, I'll give you just a few facts about them. We have 8 individuals, or about 25%, who live there with life-threatening conditions. About half the people need 24-hour nursing care. Everybody uses a wheelchair. Everybody requires total care, dressing, toileting, grooming, that sort of thing. We have about over 8,000 medical prescriptions for the 32 people who live there, and we administer, or we make, about 190,000 administrations of medication to these individuals for all 32 of them over the course of a year. So you can see how intense the needs are. We're proposing this relocation plan and seeking legislative funding because while the residents may not be in danger at the moment, their circumstances are deteriorating. And the reasons why those circumstances are deteriorating have to do with many, many things. One is federal and state policy, especially the state financial disincentives that are on the continued operations of facilities that are of this nature. We are suffering huge financial losses because of these financial disincentives. In the last 5 years, for this facility, which has a budget of about $3.5 million a year, we've lost between $40,000 and $90,000 each year. The already high health care needs that this population has is getting or are growing. To give you an example of that, in the last 5 years, the number of hospital days, or the number of days that these folks have been in the hospital, have increased about 40%. And finally, we've got an aging building. It was built in 1979. We've had a lot of evaluations on it. And we're facing about $600,000 worth of estimated repairs and renovations that we need and that we cannot afford to pay for. I just wanted to note that the legislature has taken a look at these special cases in the past and enacted. In 1995, for instance, we came to the legislature and asked for additional funding to enhance MRRC waiver rates and also for an interim rate to close the 64-bed facility in New Hope that I mentioned earlier. That request was granted, and the facility closed successfully in 1997. And then in 1999, the legislature authorized the Lake Owosso project, where again a 64-bed ICF was closed and smaller homes were constructed. So I want to thank the committee and the chair for your time and consideration of this bill, and we're open for questions, I guess.
Could you spell your last name for us?
Oh, sure.
Don, I can figure out.
Yeah. That's what everybody says. Preeby is P as in Paul, R, I, E, B as in boy, E. Lots of E's and B's.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. Questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that, you know, you have certainly some needs that you've spelled out in terms of moving from where you are into smaller units. It seemed all of that depends on the cost or money reimbursement issues. What's really better for the people, for the residents? And I've got three questions, but what do you think is the better? Is it better to move them into smaller units or to keep them in a good, larger facility where you can have the centralized services?
It's been state and federal policy for decades now, really, moving from larger to smaller. And most of the research that I'm familiar with indicates that people flourish when they move into smaller homes. We certainly saw that when we closed the 64-bed home and people moved into four-bed homes. Smaller behavior problems that we had disappeared when people went to smaller, more home-like atmospheres.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Speaker, what is the difference in cost of moving? I mean, you're talking about the costs in this, but you would have to then purchase or build smaller homes for these. What is the difference in cost?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my estimates are approximately $715,000 extra a year going forward for funding the services at the smaller homes. And then approximately $605,000 one time to close the larger facility. Those are my estimates.
And is that, Mr. Chair, is that $15,000 or $16,000 per home?
No, that's $700,000. The costs are different because one of the homes serves extremely needy people. The rates there will be more expensive. They will have 24-hour nursing, and people will not leave for day services. So that's the most expensive one. The second home also will have 24-hour nursing, but people will be for day services. That's less expensive. And then the two other facilities are the least expensive ones. Those are for people who need substantial nursing care, but not 24-hour, and who will also leave for day services.
Representative Peterson.
My last, maybe it's not a question, but you may want to comment on it. I have several communities in my area that are extremely concerned about the clustering of these group homes and the loss then of communities and people moving because they see clusters. And many the cities of the first class have, as you know, distance regulations, and I know there certainly is a move afoot to see that same kind of distance between the homes is implemented in all communities, and that being with the idea that if you really want good integration into the communities, as it seemed to be the goal initially for group homes, for these smaller entities, then you do need to find, you know, spaces rather than clustering. Mm-hmm. And maybe you wish to comment on that. It is a very difficult issue for several of my communities, and one which we're addressing with community meetings, et cetera. So you may want to comment on that.
Mr. Breeby.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I've been involved in the opening of probably over 100 different types of community homes across my career. There's only been two times where I've had difficulty with neighbors and had to appear and explain to them what we were doing and why we were doing it. But to reassure the members of the committee, there are some requirements about distances for these kinds of homes. I believe they have to be about a quarter mile apart. That's my belief. I'm not absolutely certain about that, but I do think that's true.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, you're saying that because these are perhaps more severe need, that there are different regulations for these particular homes rather than the other kinds of group homes that we have in communities?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's my belief that an ICFMR, which is what these homes would be, have to be a quarter mile apart.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson or Mr. Preedy, I don't see, this bill was introduced on the 22nd of February, and I don't see a fiscal note. Can you give me an explanation as to what the situation is with that? I also have follow-up questions besides that.
Representative Nelson.
I don't know why there's not a fiscal note. I know there's a blank line in the bill, and as Mr. Preedy talked about, we're looking at it. $2 million for the biennium is what that cost is what we're estimating. Now that's from the Homer Bounds estimate. There's some cost savings that would come to Hennepin County from this, so there might be a wash as far as what the overall cost is. But I haven't gotten a fiscal note on it. So,
Representative Anderson, we don't have a fiscal note yet. We'll certainly get one before the final bill is put together.
Boy, I sure hope so. Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, what's the current rate? It's kind of unusual to see rates here being put in statute. What is your current rate that you're paying? And what, and we see the rate here, and I was already going to ask about rates at a larger versus a smaller facility. Somewhat sounds like it's going to be a little bit more, like you say, difference in cost was $715,000. What is the rate right now that's being paid?
Mr. Preeby.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brooklyn Park's current rate is $309.82, I believe.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Preeby, is that, are you, you say you're falling behind now on that rate right now with your situation?
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, that's correct. We are losing, as I said, in the last 5 years, between $40,000 and $90,000 a year to provide services to the folks and keep the building.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Preedy, you're going to go to a smaller facility and you're going to increase the costs, my understanding, because you're going to go to smaller facilities. How do we manage to keep the costs down?
Mr. Preedy.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we'll do the best we possibly can to keep our costs down. We're willing to provide some resources to help this project too, such as we're going to make the down payments on the facilities and the land to try and keep the costs as low as we can keep them.
And one final question.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peavy, why does it have to be located only in Hennepin County?
Mr. Peavy.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, ICFMR beds are typically decided upon by committee, and you're testing my knowledge here, are typically decided upon by needs reviews within the county, and counties typically don't want to lose these kinds of beds because they serve people with very, very high needs, and so they're very valuable to counties.
Mr. Prevey, or maybe someone from the department could answer, is there a difference in federal or state reimbursement if you get six beds or less in the facility?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't believe there's any difference except the reimbursement is by person. And so if you have four people living there, you're obviously going to have lower revenue than if you have six people living there. So one of the reasons why we're suggesting that we have six instead of four is to keep the costs down.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Prevey or Representative Nelson, would your facilities receive a COLA increase under the governor's proposal and Representative Huntley's proposal?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we would not receive a COLA increase in the year that we're doing this project.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to raise a little more general question that came to me in listening to your testimony. I understand the general movement in the last, 15, 20 years for developmentally and otherwise disabled and other kinds of folks to move into community settings, and we all know the pros of doing that, though. But given what you described at the outset of the system about the type of severe disabilities that you're dealing with, the level of round-the-clock 24-hour care, the number of prescriptions involved, and all that kind of thing, it strikes me that moving from a larger facility to six or under, that you're losing tremendous economies of scale and staffing and in having a person fill those drug cups and all kinds of other things, because I'm not sure how many staff you could have for only 4 to 6 people at any one time. And so it strikes me in this instance, more were things like physical therapy equipment in the facility, other kinds of special equipment, exercise facilities, a pool even maybe, things, whatever. It seems like you can't afford those things on a 4 to 6 bed facility, but you might be able to have them in a larger facility. So I was wondering how you respond to those issues.
Mr. Prevey.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't set state policy and federal policy, and for 20 years plus, we've been moving people from larger places to smaller places. And Homeward Bound is trying to develop a plan so it can accommodate itself to that movement. People with severe disabilities, including disabilities of this type, are being served in smaller homes. And I guess our perspective is we can't continue to do what we're doing right now with the fiscal disincentives in place and with the state policy and federal policy in place. We need to come up with a plan to secure the future of the services of the people who live there. And they're so extremely vulnerable that we are convinced we have to move quickly.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one other question. I know the purpose, of moving to smaller group homes, neighborhoods, et cetera, is that integration. But these at least sounds like these particular residents are not going to be able to integrate very well into the community because of their extreme needs. Can you address that? Do you have any experience with that? Do they integrate at all into the community, or is this a smaller place that could, a smaller home that could be anywhere?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Prevey.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the answer is yes, they do integrate. We get them out as much as we can. In some cases, because of the kinds of medical problems that they have to be accompanied by nurses. And so it's difficult for us. It's not as easy as everybody running out the door and jumping in the van and heading off to the movie theater. We have to do a lot of planning. We have handicapped accessible vans that are specially created to move individuals who have these kinds of needs. And we try and get folks out 2 or 3 times a week.
Mr. Chair, this facility is
down the block from my house, and during the summertime and when the weather is good, their attendance, they have the people that can get out. They're out on the streets all the time. You know, we see them all the time.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask the question before, but I just wanted to get from Mr. Preedy. You mentioned the federal and state disincentives. Can you just elaborate on what they are?
Sure. Mr. Preedy.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the let me see if I can. Primarily, the financial disincentives have come about since 2002. One of the most important ones is one that requires counties to pay a portion of the cost of care for ICF MRs that have larger than or more than seven individuals. That disincentive was modified, I believe, last year. I'm not sure. I think it was last year. But that has encouraged counties to look at ways in which larger facilities can be downsized and closed because now they're paying part of the cost. We were told in September of 2004 by the director the past director of DHS's Disabilities Division that these fiscal disincentives would stay in place and that they were put in place to encourage the downsizing of larger facilities. One of the most damaging financial disincentives is the lack of a mechanism by which DHS can respond to growing service needs or building issues by authorizing higher payment rates. There are only a very, very small number of ways in which DHS now can authorize higher payment rates, and this is not one of them. So those are some of the fiscal disincentives that I'm speaking about.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, with that, then House File 1583 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And next, we're going to have Representative Thiessen on House File 911. And I would ask you to try to be as brief as possible so we can get to the last bill after this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't even have to move anything, right? Or do we move it? So
it's I'll move the...
Or I can move it so it's before the committee, House Bill 911, for possible consideration of the omnibus bill. And I'll just let Ms. Henry talk. How about that, for brief?
Did you choose the House file number, Representative Thiessen?
No, I didn't.
Mr. Chair and members of the division, my name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center, and we represent persons across Minnesota with significant disabilities, including developmental, serious mental health problems, traumatic brain injury, MS, and so on. And actually, it's an apt number for the bill because we do have a lot of problems for people with disabilities in our state since we've had our budget crushed for the last 4 years. And this bill would help. And the reason that this bill would help is because it would allow, I think, over 10,000 people, maybe even upwards of that number, to flexibly use money they already have access to on the personal care assistant program. And in a way they can't right now. They can only use those dollars for staffing hours, and they have a hard time filling the hours because the pay is low. This would allow people to access money they now have the right to get because they're eligible in a flexible manner. And we think it would help the waiting list. We think it will help families who are keeping people at home because if they need to widen the doorway to a bathroom or get assistive technology or respite care, they could use this funding for it. Otherwise, they have to get in line for a home and community waiver slot. Now, I haven't seen a fiscal note for this, but it's my understanding that the first two sections of the bill, the self-directed support section, are about $900,000. Am I correct? There is no fiscal note for the committee? Okay. I'm going to tell you what I know
of in terms of technical assistance I've gotten pressing for a fiscal note for the bill. So $900,000, it would be an investment in staff and systems work at the department, but the service costs are already in the system, and that's one of the very good things about this bill. The second aspect of the bill would allow a housing subsidy called a shelter needy payment for people who are otherwise eligible for institutional level of care or getting this new self-directed supports option to live more independently. Right now, because of housing costs, we have folks who are living in four-bed group homes who actually could live more independently with less service, but they can't afford to. So this would give them, through the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program, up to another $150 a month. They probably still have to share an apartment, but at least they could live more independently. And that, I am told, costs about $1 million, and these are biennium figures, about $1 million to do that. And I don't know, because I haven't seen the fiscal note, whether that includes service cost savings, because we expect some people would leave 24-hour settings, and so they would need they would not use as many services. And then finally, the third aspect of the bill, youth licensing, has no cost. It's to develop a license for youth with disabilities and come back next session and keep a few programs going with some license provisions until that time. So we think this is an extremely important bill, and in a time of very tight budget, it really could provide a lot of assistance by basically providing flexibility for funding people are already eligible for. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Henry? We're going to have Steve Larson, too. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm Steve Larson with the ARCA Minnesota and committee members, and I'll just keep my comments brief that this impacts persons with all disabilities, would greatly help out the waiting list that you've had presentations on during the course of this session, and as Ms. Henry emphasized, this would allow a great amount of flexibility, creativity, and allow people to receive the staffing hours that they need, as well as the assistive technology and adaptive technology that they would need to stay in their homes. In addition, start moving us in the direction of giving consumers greater control of the housing that governmental dollars are paying for. So the ARCA Minnesota and the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities have this as a high priority for this legislative session. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. Either Representative Thiessen or your testifier, are we leveraging federal dollars in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, we're leveraging the same dollars. It's MA dollars, so we're leveraging the same dollars that we would otherwise be leveraging. Yes.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen, could we just, from a ballpark figure, just from what Ms. Henry said, figure about $2 million for this bill or more?
Representative Anderson, based on what she said, that's what my math would be, too.
Thank you.
I think this really is a great direction for us to be heading. The federal government, in the one of the good things about the Deficit Reduction Act is it included the allowance of this bill, and I really don't see why we wouldn't give folks more flexibility to spend the money on stuff they really need or have money spent on things that they really need. So I think this is a great thing to do.
Okay, any further questions? House File 911 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. And last today is House File 781, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is, first of all, I'd like to move this for possible inclusion. and to say that this is another step in our effort to right-size long-term care living options for persons with developmental disabilities. This bill is, like Representative Nelson's, dealing with a particular facility, an ICFMR, intermediate care facility for persons with mental retardation, that would like to downsize as well as deal with the issue of accessibility. Rem Pleasant currently is a 15-bed Class A facility in South Minneapolis, and it's been around since the mid-1970s and in serving an aging population, many of whom have been with them for a long time. And their physical plant is old. It isn't handicap accessible, and as their residents age, that is an increasing issue, particularly when for the younger adults with disabilities, they're looking for other opportunities. This bill would provide for the conversion of the existing facility into 2 6-beds Class B facilities that would be both handicap accessible and provide additional staffing given the inefficiencies that when you become smaller, but also because they're targeting a much more aged and dependent population. Hennepin County has supported this proposal, and the proposal is before us because this is the mechanism by which the state considers the policy and the funding, because this will be more expensive than the current facility. The estimated state share is about $160,000 a year. But this facility has actually had people who have been long-term residents have to go to a nursing home because they have not been able to maintain the level of services and the accessible housing that they need. And so when you contrast that with moving people to nursing homes, there is some cost savings. That said, I'm going to introduce Nita Hayes, who's with REM Minnesota, who will give you some further background about the bill.
Ms. Hayes.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for letting me testify on behalf of REM Pleasant. My name is Nita Hayes, and I bring this before the committee because there is no other mechanism to resolve our issues. Our building is approximately 100 years old, and we have looked at every which way to put an elevator, chairs, stairs, etc. In 2006, we were at half occupancy because of losing people to accessible nursing homes due to issues that are medical in nature. We're really wanting to focus on meeting the needs of the people we serve to allow them choice. Because there is no mechanism to address rate adjustments, we've gone to Hennepin County and met with them over a period of 1 year to look at options for that would best serve this resolution. Hennepin County feels that this is the best plan for the individual served. It's cheaper because it would keep people out of nursing homes, and that going to smaller settings and waivers would be more costly and cost prohibitive, because of the most individuals we serve are not only aging in place with mental retardation, but have mental health issues as well. So the reason to split into two programs is to convert existing housing and make it accessible without having new construction costs and such. So that helps us hold the cost down and be the cheapest alternative. The rates proposed were reviewed by the Department of Human Services and are well below the average for Class B programs. They average about 250 a day. We're coming in at about 200 a day. And so it is, we've worked very hard to look at what is best for the taxpayers, the people served, and for the county. With the current per diem, it allows for $8.13 a day for housing costs. To get into an accessible housing is about $30 a day when you add up the life safety code requirements and a building remodel, etc. And so this has forced us to come before you to ask for support in keeping services manageable cost-wise, and we need to go from a Class A to a Class B, Class A basically are programs that allow people to have self-evacuation skills in case of a fire emergency. And a Class B is an accessible program that allows the individual to not meet those self-preservation skill sets. And so as our people are aging in place and having dementia, et cetera, this has driven people to have to leave their homes because of the regulations in the Class A versus Class B. So with that, it is why we are here, why I am here today to ask for your support in passing this on to the Omnibus Bill. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if the department could shed some light on why there's such a difference in reimbursement rates between Representative Loeffler's bill and Representative Nelson's bill when they're both level B intermediate care facilities. Could they help us out on that?
I may be able to answer some of that in that we are currently serving an ambulatory population and the that are having, that are struggling with stairs and so forth, and we are not doing the high intensive nursing support in our program in comparison.
Further questions? Seeing none, then House File 781 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Law. And Ms. Hayes. And with that, I guess we're adjourned.